Lost opening title noise. Welcome to Casual Trek. This is normally a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and Eugenics. So make your comeback, get your skull shape in order. And I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn. I'm a writer and a Lost in Space fan. Both the Netflixy one and, of course, one featuring my personal hero, Dr. Zachary Smith. What?
Matt LeBlanc.
The 90s. Getting that one exists, and it's probably better that way.
And I am Marzri Lobato, a science fiction writer, owner of a skull, and a fan of the BBC radio serial Journey into Space.
Ooh. So, normally we look at stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on a big list of best to worst, but an exciting thing has happened. I say an exciting thing, I've only just got to listening to them yesterday, but there is a podcast that is an official Star Trek thing. It's Star Trek Con! But before we can go on about it a bit more, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying lately?
I have finished a book. Not one I wrote myself. Oh, no. That would require a lot more effort and far less mental illness to achieve. But I finished reading a book. It is by Charlie Jane Anders. It is called Lessons in Magic and Disaster. It is a fantasy about a woman who is a academic and practices witchcraft, who in an attempt to reunite, spend more time with her grieving mother, starts teaching her how to do magic, and it all goes just as well as you can imagine when you try and teach your mother how to mess with the fundamental building blocks of the universe.
Hijinks ensue, then.
Hijinks ensue. It's a really good book. I love all of Charlie Jane Anders' novels that they have put out. And I admit there were some parts which did hit pretty hard for me. One is because mother issues. Who doesn't? You can have them as well as father issues, I found out in my life. And also, the mother's wife passes from cancer, and that chapter was particularly hard to read because, shit, that pain ain't ever going away.
No, I could. I have some of Charlie Jane Anders' other novels, but yeah. With things like that, sometimes it's like shit.
It's only like in one chapter, but it's still hard to read. And also, like, if you've ever been on the outs with your mother for whatever reason, parts of the novel do feel a bit too real.
At some point, I do need to get into reading some of the Charlie Jane Anders prose that I've got. I loved their work on IO9 and they obviously have a great grasp of genre fiction.
Which ones have you got?
I would need to be in my bedroom with the shelves.
Shelves, my mortal enemy.
Yeah,
they keep betraying me. The City in the Middle of the Night was one I've read, and that's a really good one. I've read the first book of her YA space opera trilogy, and that's a lot of fun. I need to get round to, you know, finishing the trilogy, but I also need to get around to reading, say, I don't know, the novels of Charles Dickens, a writer who I've sadly never read. Eventually, I will finish The Dark Tower, and, you know, eventually I will finish the Hyperion Cantos. But also, eventually, you know, I will have the free time with which to read books.
Yeah, I mean, as far as old sea dicks, I'd say, I think Nicholas Nickleby was one of his that I abandoned pretty hardly and brutally. It was one of those ones where you remember that he is his own editor and he is paid by the word, and given it was done as a serial thing, there are whole sections where he didn't feel like writing this story, so instead he'd have someone tell a different story, and that's going to take up the entire thing. And while that would normally be a blessed relief, it somehow wasn't.
Can I ask you a question? I know it's a bit early in the podcast, me asking you a question.
Yeah.
But whenever you hear the phrase "paid by the word," don't you just kind of look wistfully off into space and go, "Wouldn't that be nice?"
I mean, yeah. I've got friends who write for RPGs who are paid by the word, but annoyingly, the better the company, the worse the word rate is for it. Yeah, luckily some of the things that I've done RPG writing wise have been just paid by the article and no more than X amount of words. And some RPG designers are even paying by time instead, which is quite nice.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like we miss that era. You have stuff like web serial, like people publishing fiction on their blogs, but like, you know, it feels like a form that, you know, you would get your local newspaper and have like the latest Dickens or Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin, which is a fantastic book, was originally serialized in the San Francisco Chronicle. And there's a lovely story where someone wrote in saying, I think this character is actually such and such, huge spoiler for the book, because of these reasons. And Armistead Maupin read it, went, actually, that's a really good idea. It's just kind of like that wonderful immediacy of fiction, which we do have, but we don't have at the same time.
Yeah, I do love the idea of serialized fiction. It's definitely something I want to take a stab at some point, beyond just wanting to do serialized fiction in the form of comics. But it's always an interesting thing.
It's something I've always kind of wanted to do, but also realizing that doing so would require a level of dedication and sticking to a schedule, which this podcast is the most I've ever stuck to a schedule in my life, and I hate it. Because every 2 weeks is like, well, shit, I have X amount of free time, and I've got to watch 3 hours of Star Trek. If I am lucky, 1 hour will be good. Hopefully 1.5. Hang on, what episode am I doing? Plato's Stepchildren. Fuck.
I admit I'm someone who... I used to keep a regular word count spreadsheet and would have some writing every single day. And sadly, that is a habit that's long since gone. But I do find having habits, having rituals, and trying to control the good habits something I'm often eager to do and often clash against. Hence things like this, which have been good fun to do, but I don't know, somehow exercise hasn't managed to make it onto that.
Tell me about it. I mean, be honest, haven't there been some weeks where you're like, but I don't want to watch Star Trek?
I don't know, like, I sometimes it's been logistically difficult, it's rare that I have a time where I'm like, oh, I really don't want to watch these ones. Between just getting to have a bit of conversation with
yourself. Bit of a bant.
Exactly. Bit of the old bants. And sometimes whether it's good or bad, going, well, this is going to be an experience.
Yep. And that was a Section 31 movie.
Oh, my God.
Still, yeah. I think my favorite memory is like 20 minutes into watching that film, phoning Celeste up and go, I think I owe you an apology.
Yeah. So well done for finishing a book.
So, Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you enjoyed this week?
I only went and finished a video game.
Holy shit, tell me your secrets.
I know, and it's not... Mario Sunshine, sadly, because I'm stuck on levels where your flood backpack gets taken away and have to do some intricate platforming that the GameCube, frankly, doesn't handle well.
Okay, was it Bubsy 3D? Because you might get a Nobel Prize for that.
No, I've never played a Bubsy. I have, however, finished Hades.
Oh!
Yeah, as of time of recording, we're like 3 days away from Hades 2 getting released on the Switch. And that lit a fire under my arse. I was like, oh god, but I've not properly finished actual Hades yet. And I love a roguelite. So
what finally motivated me to finish Death Stranding 1?
Exactly. It is a good motivator. Because I was like, well, I already know that Emma and I are going to be sharing time on the Switch 2. Passing it back and forth for this, so this way I can at least take part in it rather than just looking longingly at the Switch going, oh, that could be me, and Emma can't even talk to me about what's going on. Similar to with Baldur's Gate 3, I've not finished it yet, and she's still frustrated that she can't discuss with me the ending of it and the choices made, because I don't want those spoilers. But we're here to talk about Star Trek Khan! So, yeah, I hadn't intended on listening to this, frankly. When you messaged and said, are we going to talk about Star Trek Khan? I was like, good. I mean, I was going to listen to it one day, but, you know, I've got a lot of podcasts that I'm listening to. So, yeah, but I'm pleased that I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been good fun. Yeah, so I guess the broad strokes here are we're only going to be talking about the first three because three have been released so far. That's Paradise, Scheherazade, and Do Your Worst, which aired on the 8th, 15th, and 22nd of September 2025. Written by Kirsten Breyer and David Mack. No, not the comic artist. Based on a story by Nicholas Meyer, who was the uncredited screenplay writer for Star Trek 2 and the screenplay writer for Star Trek 4 and 6. So, you know, given the common wisdom that the even-numbered ones are good, that's kind of a good sign. And directed by Fred Greenhay and surrounded by way too many adverts.
Yeah, that was my big problem.
I listened to a number of fiction podcasts. You know, I was a Night Vale listener for years before kind of giving up as it felt it had gone off the boil a bit. Was it Wolf 359? Not the Star Trek catastrophe, but there was a fun podcast with that.
I kept meaning to listen to that one.
It was good, and it ended, which also is good. And the Silt Verses, which I adored. And again, three seasons and out.
Keep meaning to listen to that one. Have you listened to Are You Afraid of the Dark Universe?
No. Heard is good.
Especially as a creative who overthinks things way too much, I feel that kind of shit will be up your alley.
Definitely. So yeah, I'm fine with them. I like them, but I think this is the most official podcast I've ever listened to, because most podcasts, when I listen to them, they are either their own thing or talking about something. I think the official Lost podcast was early enough that it wasn't as professionally done. It was mostly just Damon Lindelof and Colton Cuse chatting about stuff and erroneously telling us that they had a long-term plan, which if they didn't do that, maybe people would have been happier with where it ended. But
I don't know, because I feel like this might just be me. A lot of fans these days feel like there needs to, you know, feels like there has to be a complete plan. And not just the fundamental truth about fiction writing, which is 8 times out of 10, you've got a basic outline, and you might be heading towards your conclusion, but most of the time, you are like Gromit in the wrong trousers on that train car, just putting down bits of track and hoping you don't run out or crash into anything.
Well, yeah, and reading a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff about Lost, which I do still love, both in mainly in The Revolution was televised by Alan Sepinwall, if I remember correctly, which went into the backgrounds of several genre-defining and format-defining TV shows, and also Mo Ryan's Burn It Down, which goes into some of the more difficult elements of the production of Lost. It's really interesting seeing the pilot was made with no real expectation that it would get picked up for a whole thing. And of course, network TV, especially at the time, you make a pilot, you make the first couple of episodes, you make the first half season, you make the first season. Each of these is a point where you could be cancelled. So you do not make a 6-year plan.
No.
You don't make any long-term plan. You lay the seeds down. And this is ongoing network TV. So when people go, oh yeah, we're making it up. Yes, welcome to fiction. Yes.
They didn't know. It's like Twin Peaks. I don't think they knew offhand who killed Laura Palmer. It's just that when they got to, they were told you, and originally they never wanted to solve who killed Laura Palmer. It was just, they were told by the network, we have to find out, you have to solve the murder of who killed Laura Palmer. They did. And the show, even though the show was still better than 90% of what was coming out at the time, which I feel a lot of people kind of forget with Twin Peaks, is that even at its most plate spinny, it was still a lot better and a lot more innovative than a lot of what was going on network TV at the time. But yeah, the wheels do kind of come off as they solve the central murder and are looking for something to regain that level of interest.
Yeah, there is a definite lull that happens there. But
like the X-Files, where there is clearly no plan as to what the conspiracy is, and it's quite evident by about the second retcon of when they've kind of retconned like what the conspiracy is. The amount of times Mulder, all this shit Mulder has been going through, and you got this guy go, oh no, you see, we faked it all. Faked the conspiracy because of American military industrial complex. Like, but what about all the times when Mulder encountered fucking shape-shifting bounty hunters who all look like Brian Thompson from that one episode of Star Trek The Next Generation?
Oh, good old Brian Thompson.
B-Toms.
Yeah, he's got such a distinctive monster man face. It's great. But away from that to a genetically engineered monster, or is he? Yeah, what is Star Trek Khan about?
Okay, let's put it this way. I'll try and sum it up best I can.
Yeah.
Space Seed. The Enterprise meets the Botany Bay, a prison ship filled with a bunch of genetically augmented fascist supermen from the eugenics wars of the 90s, and their leader, Khan Noonien Singh, who is a dignified, regal, charismatic presence who tries to take over the Enterprise with the help of the ship's historian, who he kind of seduces over to his side. The plan goes wrong, and Kirk exiles Khan and his people to the planets of Seti Alpha 5 with all the tools they need to build themselves a new society. Then, 20 or so years later, in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, we meet Khan Noonien Singh, a bronze-chested crazy man who has a severe hate-on for James T. Kirk, because it turns out that the planet of Seti Alpha 6 exploded, and thus devastating Seti Alpha 5 and killing most of the augments, including the historian who was Khan's wife, thus dedicating Khan to be Kirk's number one best foe forever. Like, Khan just like, I will dedicate myself to destroying you and all I hold dear. And Kirk's like, sorry, who are you again?
Yeah, yeah. They, while it is an amazing film and currently number one of our list on best to worst Star Treks, it does feel like a lot more of a one-sided nemesis-ing going on from Khan.
Yeah, I think that's just kind of like the pop culture. It's like the pop culture osmosis that, like, that Kirk has always been this, like, swaggering ladies' man who will buck the rules whenever they need to be bucked. In the same way that Khan kind of became Kirk's big bad, Star Trek Into Darkness did not help this by having Leonard Nimoy turn up and go, yeah, Khan was, like, our biggest foe. I should know. I died. But I got that. I wish there was a scene. Star Trek Into Darkness, we'll get to eventually. Half of it is actually a really good film. I honestly like the first half of it. But
still surprised by that.
But the moment, like, I feel like it's one of the few Star Trek films to really kind of take the post 9/11 kind of a waging war for defense ideas. And I feel it actually tries to approach it from a very interesting standpoint. Then Benedict Cumberbatch goes, I am Khan! And the entire film just slaloms into a mess. Like, what a waste of Peter Weller.
Yeah.
What a waste of Dr. Buckaroo Banzai himself. But, like, I feel like it was that film that kind of was one of the things that helped solidify Khan as being Kirk's big foe. Also, I just think it's Ricardo Montalban's just, like, fucking amazing presence in that film, because he steals the show and never meets Shatner once.
Yeah, like, his intensity is so good. And while we've said multiple times before that unnamed Romulan commander and Core are both more, like, valid nemesis BFFs for life, kind of thing.
Even though 90% of that for Core is just, again, Core just really wants Kirk to be like his sworn enemy across the whole of space.
Yeah, just acknowledge me. At the same time, Khan, actually, in these first three episodes, I can kind of see that the intensity, the hatred that he has, like, is like in Star Trek 2. It feels like maybe he's just like that.
Yeah. The actor they get to play Khan is Naveen Andrews, who played Saeed in Lost, hence all the Lost episodes. I think Saeed is the male character on Lost who my wife finds the sexiest. Jack is tedious, and she hates Sawyer. She just wants bad things to happen to Sawyer. But as I tell her, it's okay. At this point in the show, Sawyer wants bad things to happen to Sawyer. You don't want bad things to happen to Sawyer any more than Sawyer wants them to happen to Sawyer.
Yeah, I feel with Sawyer, I grew to like him in season 5. But that takes a lot of things, including time travel.
Yeah, and Sawyer does a lot to not make you... Sawyer just comes in going, I am going to be the most attested guy on this island. And succeeds.
Yeah. So, so you've got Naveen Andrews. You've got Ren Schmidt, who apparently was in For All Mankind, as Dr. Marla MacGyver's. I did spell that like the Guyver in my notes because I forgot that it's spelt MacGyver's. There's also Sonia Cassidy as Dr. Rosalind Lear, Tim Russ as Ensign Tuvok, and George Takei, of course, as Sulu. It's interesting seeing a couple of proper Star Trek names there, especially Tim Russ, where I talked to my partner about this and went, oh yeah, George Takei's in it and someone else, and literally hit pause partway through listening to it yesterday. I went, it's Tim Russ, because I know that she's seen more Voyager than me. We were only recently talking about how Seven and Tuvok made a bit more sense than Seven and Chakotay.
And of course, Tim Russ, who is in Spaceballs, who delivers the iconic line, "We ain't found shit!" when they're quite literally combing the deck. Spaceballs is a film I really don't like, but there are so many gags in it which are hilarious. It's just, whenever it's clear from Spaceballs that Mel Brooks does not have the same affection for science fiction as he does for, say, Westerns, yeah, or for like old Universal horror movies like in Young Frankenstein. So when the film is parodying like the cliches and tropes of science fiction broadly, it's hilarious. The "Oh no, not again" diner with the alien and John Hurt is always hilarious. But when it's directly parodying Star Wars, it just feels very kind of mean-spirited.
Yeah. I feel with Mel Brooks quite often there are so many bits that go on that some are gonna hit.
Like, yeah,
no matter what, some of them are gonna be great.
It's like Airplane or like The Naked Gun. Like, it's gonna be just jokes like being thrown at you like every 30 seconds, and if you're lucky, you have a very decent hit rate. Whereas, like, I think Airplane has a good 90% hit rate of really good jokes. And Naked Gun, it's been a while since I've seen that film. I feel that one's like a more like 60-40.
Yeah. So with this, we've both heard all of the first three episodes, and it's one of those things where I didn't take intricate episode by episode notes. Episode 2 and 3 especially felt, I don't know, it was an interesting experience, but felt fairly light in what would need to be kept track of.
Yeah.
This starts with Dr. Rosalind Lear at a hearing because she wants to check out SETI Alpha 5 to see if there's any kind of historical remnants and anything relevant to Khan, who at this point is gone, like, done, all of that. But that's where I began to get worried, because it was that kind of, well, you know, if Starfleet weren't covering stuff up, they'd be fine with me going down there and poking around on this, you know, hell planet and all that. And, you know, just want to get some more view, and maybe this is going to make Kirk look okay, not, you know, humanize a eugenicist and a tyrant and all of that. And I was concerned by that. And yeah, there's not really anyone leaping to her defense so much as kind of going, fine, okay.
I feel like Sulu, who is at the hearing, this takes place like 3 months after Generations, where Kirk is missing, presumed dead.
Yes.
And like, the Leah is like, well, maybe Kirk intended for Khan to get wiped out in the explosion on SETI Alpha 6. And Sulu was like, and Sulu just goes, and I took that personally.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, that's where he and Tuvok are helping Dr. Leah in recovering the tapes, which is the kind of, the majority of what we hear is Dr. MacGyver's historian that she is, recounting and kind of recording the events as they go on SETI Alpha 5 as it's basically lost.
Yeah.
Like, they're trapped in the middle of nowhere. They've not really got any good ways to communicate out, and
they've basically
exiled, and they're
exiled, and they've got a bunch of equipment and like cargo stuff so they can build start building a settlement.
Yeah, and everyone is still very much into this whole kind of Khan is the boss, kind of like, let's do a feudalism, let's do an empire kind of thing. And Khan being Khan, like, the first thing we hear from him, the first thing is, of course, a Milton quote.
Yes. Like, you know, there's that Khan is all in on Manifest Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
It's very clear that he wants to conquer this new land. They make a reference to Cortez, where he tells MacGyver's, "Oh, when Cortez began to plunder Mexico, he burnt his ships so that he and his men can only strive forward." And MacGyver's like, "Actually, he left one ship behind so he could book it, and all his men would be fucked." And again,
I liked that push and pull with MacGyver's, where it feels almost like the redemption character-wise has been more of her than of Khan.
I feel like they're trying to recontextualize, because like there is a very kind of 60s misogyny of Space Seed where MacGyver's betrays everything she believes in because Khan is really sexy, you know, because, you know, women be shopping.
And as a historian, that's often overlooked by Kirk and folks, going, actually, fuck it, let's get in on the ground floor with this tyrant. Having her like dial up that sense of having felt overlooked and like nothing was worthwhile on the Enterprise, and then getting to be a historian of whatever's going on here is all well and good, but a lot of the augments and Khan have their own issues and their own shit going on.
There was some interesting stuff. We find out that all the female augments are sterile.
Yeah.
All the male augments, of course, not sterile, because, you know, that's... And you get that implication that the only reason MacGyver's is here is because she's fertile, which is a question that has been put to Khan, but Khan has not answered. And has very much danced around the issue.
Khan, their first kind of falling out is a bit like that, when MacGyver's is made aware of this situation and loses her shit a bit with him, and in that kind of, oh shit, this is what I'm being brought here for.
Red flag.
Mm-hmm. Big red flag. And the fact that she's kept some communication equipment in order to, you know, reach out if necessary, also doesn't go down well with him. It's interesting that even though most of Khan's followers are entirely eager to go down, he's in charge, this is a big empire that we're starting to build here kind of thing, both they and he and MacGyver's all have too much going on to kind of stick with that almost. I don't remember us seeing much of his underlings in Space Seed.
He just has tough guys, much in the same way that, like, I think there is the one Joaquim who they refer to, who I think is his blonde follower, like his main follower in Wrath of Khan.
Yes, that's his boy from Wrath of Khan.
Yeah,
and given the, like, he's a hybrid kind of human augment, and you know, he mentions in, I think, the second episode about the kids that were there and how he's viewed them as his kids rather than just the colonies, the people's kids, and seeing them grow up and all that. It's like, yeah, this all feels pretty doomed.
This has cult mentality written all over it. Even if you weren't a eugenicist super Hitler, you know, this is a cult. You are one bad day away from this all going to shit. And okay, so in the three episodes that we have listened to so far, do you think that the show has made any attempt to kind of go, oh, you know, Khan wasn't bad, just misunderstood? Or is it just kind of the case of Khan is too wrapped up in Khan's own ego, because the moment anything goes wrong that he has no say in, he just turns nasty straight away?
I think it's it's done a lot to humanize him, but not in a good way.
Yes.
You know, like, sorry, quality-wise good, not in a good aligned way. He was perfect, but one bad day made him evil.
No, I don't think there's any attempt to redeem Khan. No. It is just to go, this is Khan. And yeah. I think Naveen does really well. He definitely plays up the very kind of cultured Milton quoting kind of the very regal Khan that we see in Space Seed. And those few moments when he just shifts into that very nasty, where you can see just that driven maniac of Wrath of Khan just kind of sitting there going, I'm just biding my time, just biding my time.
Yes. And while it's not necessarily him that sheds the first blood, as one of his underlings, Ivan, has that honor, it's interesting seeing both his want of control, his lack of control, and how whenever things aren't going his way, you can feel he doesn't need to shout to get his displeasure across. You know, when he loses it with MacGyver's, that's there. When he is when nature finally takes a turn against them in episode 2, I don't know about you, maybe because I've been watching a lot of Alien Earth, any alien nature, I've been like, oh god, oh no, what are they going to do? What horrors are going to happen? All of this is going to be inhospitable. It's going to get in their eyes. It's going to do terrible things.
I am surprised that Werner Herzog has not been in a Star Trek. Because I feel Werner Herzog and his just kind of attitude to the universe and nature and man's relationship to nature would be perfect with Star Trek, where everything is going to kill you.
Oh god, you'd want him being some kind of admiral that's in that kind of state of like, yes, this planet wishes to kill me, but I must persevere.
This planet has rocks that explode, and I will will spit on those rocks in contempt of nature.
Yeah, and in this, you know, you do hit points where Khan feels very much like that. Like, nature gets done with these people by episode 2. And I loved that he yelled at a boar like it's his new nemesis. Like, at the end of that episode where Khan has, like, nemesishood with Kirk has ended. Nemesis, like, Boar is new nemesis now. And by the end of episode 3, he's had to, like, terrible incidents. And now nature, now this planet is his nemesis. And maybe Khan's just like this. Everything is his nemesis if it gets in his way. And Kirk's just one of the many.
That's what, like, you know, the joke, you know, there's like the long running kind of joke that he recognizes Chekhov, but Chekhov wasn't in Space Seed. And the joke has always been, Chekhov took too long in the toilet when Khan really needed a shit. And that's why he never gets him. For a brief moment, he's like, you, Pavel Chekhov, you are my nemesis. My hatred will burn for you like a thousand suns and will last until the stars run cold. And Chekhov said, I need to wash my hands, please.
Yeah, I could entirely see all three incarnations of Khan being like that.
Khan would have definitely left a one-star review of like his DoorDash order because the bag wasn't sealed. And he would be declaring that guy in his review, you are my new nemesis. My hatred for you will burn like a thousand suns until I finish my chicken McNuggets.
Yeah, like the food wasn't actually damaged. The person may have torn the bag slightly, but it was all perfectly intact.
The guy was a little late and couldn't find his Khan's flat, and that was enough to make Khan go, I will kill you.
It was disrespectful. Yeah, like when some of the learner drivers for Deliveroo end up driving the wrong way down our one-way road to get here, it's, oh, you fools. But I wouldn't rate them badly for that, because that'd be mean. Khan would be like, one star, this is obviously, you know, he cares not for his safety or the safety of my food.
I think that's just one of those things of what I think kind of fundamentally makes Khan such a great villain, is that you boil it down to it, Khan's just a petty bitch.
Yeah. One that doesn't think he is. He thinks he's a great Shakespearean villain.
He kind of reminds me of Shar Aznable in the Gundam franchise. Someone who clearly read The Count of Monte Cristo at a very young age, went, right, I'm basing my entire personality on this, and never stopped to think this was a good idea. And as such, like, and then so his great vendetta against the family who wronged him and murdered his father gets supplanted because a 15-year-old boy with no social skills beats him in a giant robot fight. And now it's just like, right, my intensity will burn for you like a thousand suns. It's like the Master in Doctor Who. It's like, he's just pissed because he's just pissed because, like, the Doctor is smarter and won't ask him out. It's very, yeah.
He got angry at some point many years ago. He hasn't been able to let it go, but can't remember why.
It's like Lex Luthor in Superman. It's what makes Lex Luthor... It's one of my favorite parts of the new Superman film, when Superman is trying to get through to Lex Luthor, and like Lex is like, yeah, you're right. I still hate you, and that's what drives me.
Yeah, I did like that. That, yeah, Lex is smart enough to know he's doing this for bad reasons, but he is not going to stop,
like,
doing it.
He knows it's unhealthy and not good. Yeah. He just doesn't care because he hates Superman more.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I do worry about attempts to humanize Lex from that, but hopefully with James Gunn, he'll manage it well. But yeah, with this, like, this does that kind of treatment really nicely. Actually getting to see Khan's own kind of logs as well, his own introspection, when, like, he runs off into the wild and tries to find Richter, and it's like, yeah.
So was the fact that one of the characters called Richter very distracting for you as an X-Men fan?
Yes, 100%. In my mind's eye, it was proper 1990s Richter with the long flowing hair.
And the headband?
And the headband, of course. And the shoulder pads. I had an action figure of him. His head couldn't turn properly because of the hair.
I mean, I like most of the logs we get are from MacGyver's. Yeah. But at the beginning of episode 3, we have one of Khan very much later down the line, where you know he is in full Byron, mourning his lost love. Clearly before he goes, wait a second, did James T. Kirk fuck me over? I will burn my hatred with you, will burn like a thousand suns. If you have a wife and child, or just a or just like an ex-girlfriend and a child, I will blow them up.
Exactly, yeah. Like, if nature and all these other nemeses that he's getting here are over with, then, you know, going backwards through the list, the most recent one that's nemesis that's still left is James Tiberius Kirk. But yeah, like,
and then after that, Chekhov.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, listening to the third episode and the presence of a pregnancy as well was like, oh no, oh dear. This, because, well, they're not necessarily completely infertile, but the attempt at doing a pregnancy, it's kind of, I guess, more difficult for them.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, with the doctors there, that's... It feels like yet another thing, like the boar, like, of course, the arrival of our friends, the Seti eel. It's all going awry already.
It's like the... Like, I feel like the good one thing is that it's not been incredibly hand-holdy. Like, it trusts you to have at least have seen Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, and maybe some passing knowledge of Space Seed. And so it, so, you know, you, we know the journey, and it's not stepped you down. It doesn't, hasn't, the story hasn't stopped to go, well, at this point, Khan was a charismatic king-like figure, and here he's like a fucking maniac with a bronze chest.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely been good for that, but, yeah, like, when Richter shows up and, like, the conflict that Khan has after he's obviously been healed, and, like, I mean, you do wonder how he had the eels, you know, I mean, not enough to go, oh my god, we must know the secret dark origin of the Seti eels, but actually going, yeah, we're getting this without intricate exposition, without too much.
We're not doing a Star Trek Strange New Worlds, hey, we have this holodeck thing. Okay. There are some really dark parts in episode 3 where Richter, who is still high up on eels, earlier, Khan hasn't worked out what the eels do. So he is telling Richter a lot of stuff, and then very surprised when he tells Richter to come down from a tree, Richter jumps down like he's that, yeah, like he's that temple maiden from Conan the Barbarian when James Earl Jones goes, "Come to me, my child." Splat. And he wakes up from being drugged. His girlfriend's there. He remembers Khan telling him to fight. And then he promptly, I don't know, he bashes her skull in.
Yes. That realization that Richter's doing everything he says, but in a terrible way. Like, this is not good. Even for someone like Khan, this is not good. And the kind of... not quite mournfulness, but yeah, there is definitely a sadness to realizing what's going on here.
And then, like, the MacGyver says, like, the only way we can find out what these eels do is through an autopsy.
Yeah.
And she's like, I could make it quick. And Khan's like, no, I'll take care of this. I thought he was just going to give him a lethal injection. And instead, Khan breaks his fucking neck.
I mean, yeah, I kind of figured it would end up being something a bit more brutal than just, you know, I'm going to put a pillow over his face or something. But there are some juicy, crunchy sound effects.
Oh, God, yeah. Right? The sound editor must have had a whale of a time going, okay, how do I do this?
Yeah.
All right, okay, oh, how crunchy do I want this?
It sounded really, like, what? It sounded like he was putting his hands through that guy's head, you know?
Oh, no, but, like, the Khan snapping the guy's neck was very much his head is now fully turned around.
Yeah.
Whereas when Richter was killing his girlfriend, I can't remember her name, there is some, like, yeah, he's definitely fucking... He is going at her like I had to go to Necromorph in Dead Space.
Yeah. It feels like a third of the way through this show, that kind of thing is only going to escalate.
And this is...
like, the world is his nemesis now.
Yeah.
That's pretty much where we're at, in between, again, egregious amounts of adverts. But, yeah. I am very much up for this series now.
It's nice to have to see, like, young Tim Russ. I mean, although, like, man, George Takei sounds very old, unfortunately. Yes.
I mean, that said, even Tim Russ sounds older than he was during all of Voyager, despite being young Tuvok. But yeah. Yeah, man, George Takei, definitely, like, old man voice to that same level where you go, oh, Patrick Stewart, maybe you don't need to keep being Picard, because, yeah.
At least not keep being JL. Be Picard, elder statesman, not JL, action hero in a jacket-wearing action hero.
Yeah. That roguish JL, but breaking all them rules all the time. Them rules.
But no, I thoroughly enjoyed this more than I thought I would.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's not, like I said, it's not fallen victim to a lot of the modern kind of Star Trek kind of wanting to give it just kind of be too, like, it's telling a good story, but it's not drowning in the fan service or the fan wank.
Yeah, now it's still got 6 episodes to make up for that, and it is written and on a story by people that are Star Trek alum, both of the older eras and of the current Paramount era. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes.
This, there was a trilogy of books done by Greg Cox, which is The Life of Khan. The first two are The Eugenics Wars, and the third one is Khan in Exile on SETI Alpha 5. I admit I may have got reserved them to pick up from the library.
Ah.
Because I'm like, okay, I just want to see like a different take on the... I'm not going to say it's going to be a better take, but I want to see a different take on the story because I want, you know, it's... Yeah. I listened to this, I enjoyed it, I thought, I kind of want to, you know, this Khan guy, I want to know more what this scallywag got up to.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, because I'm sure when this series is over, we'll return to it to discuss how it was overall. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the alternate takes were like. I remember I was looking into something relating to this earlier today and realized not just is the first line that Naveen Andrews gives as Khan a Milton quote, which of course is like, ha, well, you know, Milton didn't really know hell, this is hell and I'm gonna tame it, but also at least 2 other Khan bits of fiction are also Paradise Lost references. So yeah, it's very much...
Well, let's be honest, Khan is from the 90s, so he definitely, you know, if Khan wasn't a augmented Superman, he would definitely be hanging around a goth shop.
Definitely. Declaring the person that didn't give him correct change his nemesis.
He'd be walking around, I don't know, like Waterstones in a long black jacket, looking for like the best version of Milton.
Exactly. Yeah. The fanciest edition of Paradise Lost.
Oh, God. Well. Oh, God. You know that this Khan would have read Sandman. You know he would have been one of those kind of 90s Sandman nerds.
Yeah. Oh, well. Yes. Yeah. Declaring Netflix his nemesis. For declaring, that one as well.
Declaring Neil Gaiman to be his nemesis.
Well, fair at this point.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, well, yeah, if you think what tantalizing bits we've discussed sound intriguing, do check out, obviously, mainly Casual Trek, but we permit you to check out a second Star Trek podcast, being the official Star Trek Con! Yeah, and next time, we'll probably be back to our regular casual shenanigans, having a look at 3 Star Trek things and ranking them on our big list of best to worst. And until then, you can find us on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social, Facebook, where we have our own page for Casual Trek now, and Ko-fi, where you could sling us some money, and we will cover any official or weird Star Trek thing that you want. We're not fussy, you know, unlike that Khan, who does seem like he would be a bit.
Yeah.
And where can folks find you, Mars?
They can find me on Blue Sky at marsreadlibato.bsky.social or on my blog at mareadlibato.wordpress.com.
Lovely. And my writing can be found at fakedtales.com and at skyshark.itch.io, which is both my Blue Sky handle and an actual website where my RPG materials surface from time to time. Yeah, so with that, go do a Khan? Actually, don't. It sounds very messy and like there'll be a lot of cleaning up afterwards. So yeah. Go declare yourself a nemesis and see where that takes you.
Sean, my hatred for you will burn like a thousand suns until the stars run cold. If you have a dog, I will make fun of it. If you have a guitar, I will cut the guitar strings. I will make collect calls to your house and not pay them. And you will know, in the very end, it would be me. And then I will start an account on Twitter and put it in your name and then very loudly say that you pay for Twitter.
God, that's some intense nemesis shit. Wow. Yeah. Well, and live long and eat jelly baby, apart from Sean, I guess, because you don't know what Miles will have done to it.
Sean, there is an ancient Klingon proverb. Revenge is a dish best served with croutons.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and High podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.